A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt about live news punditry. Specifically, the marathon coverage format where a major event hits, say Iran, Israel tensions, and suddenly there are 6 hours of talking heads filling airtime. He's wondering how the back office actually works. Who's booking these people? Are producers in the earpieces just feeding lines to keep the speculation churning? And when they finally cut away to other programming, is that a creative decision or just a lagging view account? It's basically a request to peek behind the curtain at the production machinery of live punditry.
This is one of those topics where the answer is so much stranger and more mechanical than most viewers realize. And you've got two layers here, the American cable news model, and then the Israeli adaptation, which imported the format but runs it on a completely different scale and budget. The Israeli version is almost more revealing because the constraints are tighter, so you see the scaffolding more clearly.
Like seeing the stagehands during a play. But the play is about missile defense, and everyone's pretending they didn't notice.
Let's start with the thing most people don't know. There is a literal book of pundits. Every major news network maintains a guest book or contributor database. At Fox, CNN, MSNBC, these are full-time staffers whose entire job is talent booking. Their title is usually booking producer or talent coordinator, and they maintain a categorized, rated, searchable database of people who can speak on specific topics.
Like a Yelp review for pundits.
Rated on multiple axes. How telegenic are they? Do they show up on time? Can they fill 3 minutes without rambling? Do they actually move the needle on social media engagement? Do they have a memorable argument with the other side's pundit that generates clips? That last one is gold. A good on-air fight will get clipped and shared and drive tune-in for the next hour. Some booking producers have spreadsheets where they literally track combativeness score for pairings.
The pundit who calmly explains the nuance of a diplomatic framework is less valuable than the one who will call someone a useful idiot on air.
By the metrics that drive the format, yes, and that's not even a secret. I spoke with a former booking producer for a major cable network. This was back when I was doing some media consulting, and she told me they had a color-coded system. Green for reliable, articulate, won't go off the rails. Yellow for needs a tight leash, might say something spicy. Red for will absolutely create a viral moment, deploy with caution.
A heat scale for human beings. That's not dystopian at all.
The Israeli version is even more compressed because the talent pool is smaller. You're drawing from the same few hundred people. Former generals, former intelligence officers, academics from a handful of universities, a rotating cast of politicians between roles. The booking producers at channels 12, 13, and 14 are often calling the same people on the same night. There's a running joke about the former general who appears on two competing channels in the same evening, just changing his jacket between appearances.
I've seen that. You'll channel surf during a security escalation, and the same face is on three stations making the same point with slightly different wording. It's like a distributed denial of service attack on public discourse.
That brings us to the earpiece question. Yes, producers are absolutely feeding lines and direction in real time. The control room, which in Hebrew is called the galeria, borrowed from theater, has the show's senior producer, the segment producer, and often the executive producer all on comms. The host has an IFB, an interruptible fullback earpiece, and they're getting a stream of instructions. Ask him about the Iranian response timeline. Push her on the ceasefire terms. We need 30 more seconds on this segment. Stretch it. Wrap in 10.
The host is essentially a highly paid puppet with good posture.
That's too cynical. The best hosts are genuinely synthesizing information and steering conversation. But the production scaffolding is more directive than most viewers imagine. During breaking news marathons, the control room dynamic gets even more intense. You have a team essentially writing the show in real time, 3 to 5 minutes ahead of what's on air. The segment producer is in one ear of the host. The executive producer is watching the competition on a bank of monitors, and there's a separate team monitoring social media for emerging angles.
When a host suddenly says, "We're just getting word that," or "I'm being told," that's literally the producer in their ear.
In many cases, yes. Sometimes it's breaking news from the assignment desk. Other times it's, "We need to transition to a new topic. Here's your bridge line." The skill of a good live host is making that sound spontaneous and authoritative when in reality someone just fed them the sentence. Brian Williams was famously good at this before his career imploded. He could take a producer's line in his ear and deliver it as if it had just occurred to him.
There's a whole separate conversation about the Brian Williams implosion. But for now, let's talk about the marathon format specifically. How do you fill 6, 8, 10 hours of airtime when the actual new information is coming in drips?
This is where the structure becomes almost algorithmic. You start with the rolling coverage phase, the first hour or two where information is breaking. During this phase, you're cutting between field reporters, official statements, and maybe one or two expert guests who can provide context on what's known. The host is in anchor mode, authoritative, calm, synthesizing.
We don't know much yet, but here's what we do know, phase, which is always longer than it needs to be because they're padding for the next actual development.
Then you enter the analysis phase. This is where the panel format kicks in. You bring in 3 to 5 guests, typically a mix of former military, former intelligence, think tank people, maybe a regional expert from a university. The producer's goal here is to create what they call moments, exchanges that are substantive enough to justify the coverage but charged enough to keep viewers from changing the channel.
Charged, but not too charged. You don't want someone actually melting down. You want someone almost melting down.
The controlled near meltdown is the holy grail, and producers absolutely engineer this. They'll intentionally pair guests who have known disagreements. They'll tee up questions designed to surface those disagreements. They'll whisper in the host's ear. Ask the former general if he agrees with what the academic just said about the Iron Dome. The academic and the former general have been on opposite sides of this debate for 2 years. The producer knows this. The host knows this. The audience doesn't necessarily know this.
It's professional wrestling with nicer suits.
I knew you were going to go there.
I'm not wrong, though. The conflict is real, but the staging is constructed. The difference is that in news punditry, the people involved have actual expertise, and the underlying issues are important. But the format is entertainment. It uses the same structural tricks as any serialized drama. Cliffhangers before commercial breaks. Narrative arcs across a broadcast evening.
The cliffhanger before the commercial break is so formulaic that it has a name, the toss to break. The host will say something like, "When we come back, what does this mean for oil prices, and could we see a wider regional conflict? Stay with us." And then you sit through 3 minutes of car insurance ads, and when they come back, they may or may not actually address either of those questions.
May or may not is generous. It's may not at least half the time. The toss to break is a promise the show has no obligation to keep, because by the time you're back from commercials, the control room has moved on to a different angle.
The control room is making these decisions based on a mix of editorial judgment and real-time data. Every major news operation has access to minute-by-minute ratings data. Nielsen provides what's called live plus same-day metrics, and during breaking news, producers are watching those numbers like traders watching a stock ticker. If a segment is holding or building audience, they'll extend it. If viewers are bleeding, they'll pivot.
The decision to finally shift off breaking news coverage and back to regular programming, that's not editorial. That's audience retention.
It's both, but the audience retention component is larger than most news consumers would be comfortable admitting. The typical pattern is ratings spike during the initial breaking news phase, then begin a gradual decline. The network has internal thresholds. If the audience drops below a certain level and no new developments are expected, they'll begin what's called the unwind. They'll reduce the panel size. They'll shift from urgent breaking news graphics to a less alarmist visual package. They'll start doing recaps rather than live analysis. And then eventually, the executive producer makes the call to return to regular programming.
The Israeli version of this?
The Israeli version operates on a tighter clock and with less patience for dead air. Israeli broadcasters. I'm thinking of the main news operations on channels 11, 12, 13, 14. They'll run a breaking news marathon, but the rhythm is faster. More field reporter cut-ins, shorter panel segments, quicker rotation of guests. Part of this is cultural. Israeli audiences have a lower tolerance for the slow, ponderous American-style anchor monologue. Part of it is practical. During security escalations, the broadcasters know that a siren could go off at any moment, and they need to be able to pivot instantly.
There's also the fact that in Israel, during a security escalation, a significant portion of the audience has direct personal stakes. They're not watching for entertainment. They're watching because rockets might be heading toward their city. That changes the ethical calculus of the format.
It does, and this is where the prompt's reluctance to be too cynical resonates with me. The format can be cynical and exploitative, but the information function is real. During the October 7th war and its aftermath, Israeli broadcasters were providing critical information, civil defense instructions, shelter locations, home front command updates, alongside the punditry. The civil preparedness spokespeople that the prompt mentions aren't just filler. They're performing an actual public safety function.
The format contains multitudes. It's simultaneously a public service, an entertainment product, a political battleground, and a ratings-driven business. The tension between those functions is what makes it fascinating.
Let me give you a concrete example. During a major escalation, you might have the Home Front Command spokesperson scheduled for a specific time slot. But 5 minutes before that slot, there's a development, say, a report of an interception over a major city. The control room has a choice: delay the civil defense information to chase the breaking development, or stick with the scheduled public safety segment. Different networks make different calls. The more ratings-driven operations chase the development. The more public service-oriented operations stick with the safety information.
The audience never sees that choice being made. They just see what ends up on screen.
The control room is making dozens of these judgment calls per hour during a marathon broadcast, and each one reflects a set of priorities that the network may not explicitly state. This is where I think the Israeli format actually has some advantages over the American one, despite operating with a fraction of the resources. The smaller talent pool means the audience knows the faces. The stakes are more immediate. The line between pundit and participant is thinner. Your military analyst may have served in the very unit that's currently operating. Your political commentator may have been in the room for the diplomatic negotiations being discussed.
That thin line cuts both ways, though. It also means the pundits have institutional and personal loyalties that aren't always disclosed. The former general commenting on military strategy may have protégés currently making those decisions. The former negotiator analyzing diplomacy may be protecting relationships with people still in the room.
This is where the booking producer's job gets complex. They need to surface relevant expertise while also flagging potential conflicts. The better networks have guidelines about disclosure. The worse ones rely on the audience not knowing enough to ask the question.
Let's talk about the booking process in more detail. You mentioned the database. How does someone actually end up in the rotation?
There are a few paths. The most common is that someone writes an op-ed or appears on a smaller program, and a booking producer notices them. The producer reaches out, does a pre-interview. This is basically an audition over the phone, and if the person passes, they go into the database. The first few bookings are usually for lower-stakes time slots. The third hour of a breaking news marathon, when the A-list pundits have already cycled through.
The minor leagues of punditry.
If they perform well, meaning they're articulate, they generate engagement, they don't cause problems, they get promoted to better time slots. If they're particularly good, they might get a contributor contract. These contracts are fascinating documents. They typically include exclusivity clauses. You can't appear on competing networks without permission. They include a minimum number of appearances per month. And they often include what's informally called a no surprises clause. You agree not to take positions that would embarrass the network.
A no surprises clause. So the network is formally reserving the right to control what opinions their pundits express.
The phrasing is usually more lawyerly, something about consistent with the network's editorial standards. But the effect is the same, and this is perfectly legal because pundits are independent contractors, not employees. The First Amendment protects them from government censorship, but it doesn't protect them from a network deciding not to renew their contract.
Which creates a soft conformity. If you want to keep your contributor gig, you learn which opinions are welcome and which ones will get your segments cut.
This is where the format's structural incentives get troubling. The pundits who thrive are not necessarily the ones with the most accurate analysis. They're the ones who can deliver confident, memorable, clip-friendly takes that align with the network's editorial identity. If you're a nuanced thinker who says, well, it depends, there are several factors to consider. You're not getting booked for primetime.
The it depends people get the Saturday afternoon slot, if they get booked at all. The this is a disaster and here's whose fault it is. People get the primetime panel.
I want to be careful here because I don't want to overstate the cynicism. There are knowledgeable, thoughtful people who appear regularly on these panels. The format doesn't preclude expertise. But it does select for a particular kind of expertise, the kind that can be packaged into 3-minute segments with clear takeaways, the kind that generates clips.
The kind that fits into the color-coded spreadsheet.
And the spreadsheet is optimized for a very specific production workflow. Let me walk through what the hour before a panel segment actually looks like in the control room, because I think this answers the prompt's question about how producers come up with ways to keep the speculation going.
This is the part I find fascinating. The mechanics.
It's roughly 45 minutes before the segment. The segment producer, let's call her Maya, has been told by the executive producer that they're doing a panel at the top of the next hour on, say, the Iranian response to the latest Israeli operation. Maya pulls up the guest database. She filters by topic tags: Iran, military strategy, Middle East diplomacy, nuclear program. She cross-references with availability, who's already in the building, who can do a remote hit, who's not booked on a competing network in the same window.
She's basically doing a casting call in 15 minutes.
She's doing a casting call while also producing the segment that's currently on air. Maya's wearing a headset, watching the live feed, and simultaneously texting potential guests. She confirms 3 panelists. She briefs each one with a quick call. Here's the topic, here's who else is on the panel, here's the general direction we're going. The host will likely ask about X, Y, and Z. This is where the pre-interview happens. She's testing whether the guest has something to say that will work on air.
If the guest doesn't have anything fresh,
she moves on to the next name in the database. Maya has about 15 minutes to lock the panel. Once it's locked, she writes what's called a segment blueprint, a 1-page document that goes to the host, the executive producer, and the graphics team. The blueprint includes the topic, the panelists' names and titles, 3 to 4 suggested questions, any relevant facts or B-roll to have ready, and the estimated segment length with hard-out time.
The hard-out time being non-negotiable because the next segment is already scheduled.
The blueprint goes to the host about 10 minutes before air. The host reviews it, maybe asks Maya a question or two over comms, and then they're live. During the segment, Maya is in the host's ear with real-time direction. Follow up on that point. We're running long. Wrap the general. The academic hasn't spoken in 2 minutes. Bring her in. Good moment. Let it breathe.
Let it breathe. That's producer. Speak for the audience is engaged. Don't interrupt.
And then there's the more directive version. Push him on this. Ask the same question again. He didn't answer it. We need a stronger close. Can you tee up the general for a final thought? All of this is happening while the host is maintaining eye contact with the camera, tracking the conversation, and appearing to be in complete control.
The cognitive load on a good live host is impressive, even if the content is being fed to them. It's like being a simultaneous translator who also has to look calm and authoritative on camera.
It's an underappreciated skill. The best hosts make it look effortless, which is why audiences underestimate how much production is happening behind them. But here's the thing that I think most people miss. The host is not a passive vessel. A good host pushes back on the producer. I'm not asking that question, it's unfair. This guest is giving us nothing. Can we cut them early? The segment is going well. Can we steal 2 minutes from the next block? There's a constant negotiation between the host and the control room.
It's not a puppet situation. It's a collaboration, sometimes a tense one, between the person on camera and the team in the gallery.
That collaboration extends to the field reporters, too. During a breaking news marathon, the field reporters are positioned at strategic locations, outside government buildings, near military headquarters, in border communities, and they're waiting, sometimes for hours. The control room checks in with them periodically. No movement yet. Stay warm, we're coming to you in 20.
Stay warm, Producer, speak for stand in the cold and look alert while we fill time with the panel.
The field reporter's life during a marathon is difficult. They're on their feet for hours. They're filing updates that may or may not make air, and they're expected to be ready to go live with 30 seconds notice if something happens at their location. The Israeli version of this is particularly intense because something happening could mean a siren, an interception, or an impact. Field reporters in Sderot or Ashkelon during an escalation are doing this while also managing their own safety.
The network safety protocols
vary by organization. The better ones have clear guidelines: flak jackets, helmets, minimum distance from expected impact zones. The worse ones leave it to the reporter's judgment, which in a competitive environment means reporters push closer to danger than they should because that's where the story is. There's a whole ethics of care conversation here that most networks would rather not have publicly.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the minute-by-minute ratings data. How granular is that, and how directly does it shape editorial decisions?
It's extremely granular. Nielsen's system can show audience size in 15-minute increments, and during major events, they provide even more frequent updates to network clients. The executive producer has a monitor in the control room that shows the current audience, the trend line, and, critically, what the competing networks are drawing at the same moment. If your panel segment is losing audience to the competition's field report from a different location, that's actionable intelligence.
Like it's a military operation.
The language isn't an accident. Newsrooms borrow heavily from military terminology. Deploy the correspondent. Target the demographic. Hold the position. The control room during breaking news feels less like a television studio and more like a command center.
When does the marathon end? What's the actual decision process for? We're going back to regular programming.
It's usually a conversation between the executive producer, the news director, and sometimes the network president. They're weighing multiple factors. Is new information still coming in? Is the competition still covering it? What's the audience trend? Are we holding, growing, or bleeding? What's scheduled in the next programming block, and would preempting it cause problems with advertisers or affiliates?
The invisible hand in all of this.
Advertisers are a huge factor that most viewers never consider. During breaking news, some advertisers actually pull their spots. They don't want their brand associated with potentially disturbing content. This is called brand safety in the industry. So the network is making less money per hour during breaking news than during regular programming, even if the audience is larger. There's a financial incentive to wrap the marathon as soon as it's editorially defensible to do so.
The marathon format is actually a loss leader for the network. They do it because they have to. It's the core of their news identity, but it's not where they make money.
The money is in regular programming where advertisers have pre-purchased spots at premium rates. Breaking news blows up the ad schedule. Some spots get pulled, some get rescheduled, and the network is essentially burning inventory. This is why you'll sometimes see a breaking news marathon suddenly end, even though the underlying story is still developing. The financial equation tipped.
That's the kind of structural fact that should make viewers fundamentally reconsider what they're watching. The decision to stop covering a major news event isn't necessarily because the event is resolved. It's because the network's business model can't sustain indefinite coverage.
The Israeli version of this has an additional layer. During security escalations, the Israeli public broadcaster, Kan, Channel 11, has a formal public service mandate. They're required to provide continuous coverage during national emergencies. The commercial channels, 12, 13, 14, are making the same financial calculations as American networks, but with the added pressure that if they cut away while the public broadcaster is still covering the escalation, they look less committed to the public good.
Which creates a competitive dynamic where the commercial channels have to stay in breaking news mode longer than is financially optimal, because cutting first carries a reputational cost.
The reputational cost in a small, tight-knit media market like Israel is significant. Everyone knows everyone. The news directors of the competing channels used to work together at some previous outlet. The talent moves between networks. If your network gets a reputation for prioritizing profits over public service during a security crisis, that sticks.
Let's talk about the talent side for a moment. The prompt mentioned doing some appearances himself. The experience of being a guest on these panels, what's that actually like from the inside?
You arrive at the studio or get patched in remotely. Someone from production briefs you quickly. You're told you'll be on in 5 minutes, then 15 minutes pass because the previous segment ran long. Then suddenly, you're live. The host asks a question that's slightly different from what you were told to expect. There's a delay in your earpiece if you're remote, so you're hearing yourself a half second behind. You're trying to make your point while also tracking whether the host is about to cut you off.
You're aware that the other panelists are competing for airtime.
There's an unspoken rhythm to panel segments. Experienced pundits know how to signal that they want to jump in. A slight lean forward, an audible breath, a hand gesture if they're in studio. The host is managing these signals while also tracking the producer's instructions. It's a complex social dance compressed into a 3 to 5 minute segment.
The less experienced guests?
They get steamrolled. They wait for a natural pause that never comes. By the time they figure out how to interject, the segment is over. This is why networks invest in media training for their contributors. It's literally teaching people how to jump into a conversation on live television without looking rude or desperate.
Media training is a euphemism for how to interrupt effectively.
Among other things, media training also covers how to pivot from a question you don't want to answer to the point you actually want to make. How to compress a complex argument into a 15-second soundbite. How to project authority while admitting uncertainty. It's a skill set, and like any skill set, some people are naturally better at it than others.
The projecting authority while admitting uncertainty one is particularly tricky. The format punishes uncertainty. If you say we don't know yet, or it's too early to tell, you sound weak compared to the person who confidently declares what's happening based on incomplete information.
This is one of the format's deepest structural problems. The incentives reward confidence over accuracy. A pundit who makes a bold prediction that turns out wrong faces no real consequence. By the time the prediction is disproven, the news cycle has moved on. A pundit who consistently says, "We need to wait for more information," is seen as boring and stops getting booked.
The bold wrong people get invited back. The cautious right people don't. The format selects for exactly the wrong epistemic virtues.
Epistemic virtues. Look at you with the philosophy vocabulary.
I contain multitudes. Also, I've been reading.
You're right. The format structurally incentivizes overconfidence. And it's not just about individual pundits. It shapes the entire tone of coverage. During a crisis, the panels create an atmosphere of urgent certainty even when the underlying facts are uncertain. This can have real-world consequences. If a panel of former generals is confidently predicting a specific military response, that shapes public expectations. It shapes the political environment in which actual decision-makers are operating.
The panel becomes part of the story it's supposedly just analyzing.
And in Israel, this feedback loop is particularly tight. The distance between the punditry class and the decision-making class is very small. A former general on a panel tonight might be in a security cabinet meeting next month. A diplomatic commentator might be back-channeling to current negotiators. The analysis isn't separate from the action. It's part of the same ecosystem.
Which makes the booking producer's job even more consequential. They're not just filling airtime. They're shaping which voices have influence in a very direct way.
The booking producers I've spoken with are aware of this. The good ones take it seriously. They think about balance, about representation, about not amplifying voices that could cause genuine harm. The less good ones think about ratings and clip potential. The system produces both kinds.
Let's get specific about the Israeli format for a moment. You mentioned channels, 11, 12, 13, 14. What distinguishes their approaches to the punditry format?
Channel 12. Keshet is the ratings leader and their punditry style reflects that. Polished, fast-paced, high production values. They invest heavily in their anchor talent. Their panels tend to feature the most prominent names. The former chiefs of staff, the former Mossad heads, the most telegenic academics. They're the closest to the American cable news model.
The premium product.
Channel 13, Reshet, positions itself as slightly more serious, slightly less glossy. Their panels run longer, the questions are more substantive, the guests are sometimes less famous, but more specialized. They're making a deliberate choice to differentiate from 12.
We're the smart one, positioning.
Channel 14, now, news. 14 is the most overtly ideological. Their panels are constructed to advance a particular political perspective. The booking is more partisan, the questions are more leading, the panel composition is less balanced. They're not trying to hide it. That's their brand.
Channel 11, the public broadcaster.
Khan has the most complex mandate. They're supposed to be balanced, public service oriented, and comprehensive. Their panels tend to be less combative, more educational. They'll book experts who wouldn't get airtime on the commercial channels because they're not telegenic enough or their views don't fit a simple narrative. The trade-off is lower ratings and constant political pressure over their funding.
You've got four distinct editorial philosophies, all operating within the same basic format, drawing from the same limited talent pool, covering the same events. It's like four different restaurants using the same ingredients to make completely different dishes.
The ingredients, the pundits, are aware of which restaurant they're in. They adjust their presentation accordingly. The same former general will be more cautious on Khan, more provocative on 14, more polished on 12.
Which brings us back to the core question. How much of what we're watching is genuine analysis, and how much is performance?
I think the honest answer is that it's both, inseparably. The analysis is real. These are knowledgeable people drawing on genuine expertise. But the presentation is shaped by format constraints, producer direction, competitive dynamics, and individual career incentives. You can't cleanly separate the substance from the staging.
Like a documentary where the subjects are aware of the camera. The presence of the camera changes the behavior, but that doesn't mean the underlying reality is fake.
And I think the prompt's reluctance to be too cynical is the right instinct. The format is flawed, sometimes deeply, but it also serves real functions. It surfaces expertise. It provides context. It helps audiences process complex, fast-moving events. The civil preparedness information during an escalation helps people stay safe.
The format is a tool. It can be used well or poorly. The problem is that the incentive structure pushes toward using it poorly, more often than we'd like.
Understanding how the back office works. The booking databases, the segment blueprints, the real-time producer direction, the ratings-driven decision-making, that understanding doesn't make the format worthless. But it does make you a more sophisticated consumer of it. You can watch a panel segment and recognize the production choices being made. You can identify when a host is being fed a question versus when they're following their own curiosity.
You can spot the toss-to-break cliffhanger that won't actually be addressed after the commercials. You can spot the pundit who's been booked because they'll generate a clip, not because they have unique insight.
Media literacy, basically, applied specifically to the punditry format.
I think that's the most useful takeaway here. The format isn't going away. Breaking news punditry marathons are going to be with us as long as there are news events and airtime to fill. But understanding the production machinery makes you less susceptible to its manipulations. You can appreciate the genuine expertise while recognizing the staging.
It's like learning how a magic trick works. The trick is still entertaining, but you're no longer deceived by it. And sometimes, when the trick is done particularly well, the craft itself becomes part of what you appreciate. A well-produced panel segment with a skilled host, knowledgeable guests, and smart producer direction, that's impressive television. The fact that it's constructed doesn't make it less impressive, it makes it more so.
I think we pulled back the curtain about as far as it'll go. The spreadsheet of rated pundits, the color-coded combativeness scores, the segment blueprints, the hard-out times, the advertiser calculus. It's a whole hidden infrastructure that most viewers never think about.
Now they will, or at least our listeners will. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
If you took all the seamounts, underwater mountains, that rise more than 1 kilometer above the surrounding seafloor and compress them into a single landmass, the total volume would be roughly equivalent to submerging the entire land area of Tuvalu under a column of seawater 37 kilometers deep. For context, the average depth of the Pacific Ocean is about 4 kilometers.
I'm now picturing Tuvalu as a very, very deep swimming pool. To close this out, the next time you're watching a panel of pundits argue about geopolitics at 2 in the morning, remember that somewhere in a control room, a producer named Maya is watching a ratings ticker and deciding whether you're engaged enough to keep the lights on. The format is a strange hybrid of public service, theater, and business. Understanding that doesn't ruin it. It just makes it more interesting.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this operation running. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you listen. We'll be back with another one soon.
Until then, maybe watch the news with the sound off and see if you can still tell what's happening. It's a useful exercise.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.